The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and do not necessarily reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, if you're Catholic, but like me and a growing number of my friends, you have one foot and four toes out of the church because the news is making it harder and harder to justify staying, then this episode is for you. It's basically me venting to a sympathetic and wise person who shares our frustration. Dr. Paul F. Lakeland is a former Jesuit who still works among the Jesuits at Fairfield University and, as you'll hear, is fortunate to have found a nurturing parish community to stay in. Paul was an early guest on Reasonably Catholic when it was first launched, and whenever I see his byline pop up, he's always thoughtful and insightful, and he came immediately to mind as I was contemplating leaving the church for the second time. If you are on the ledge of the Catholic Church and about to jump out of a stained glass window, this episode might either give you the push you need or pull you back in. If you miss any of the show or want to share it with friends, you can find the podcast later at reasonablycatholic.com. Back in a moment with Paul Lakeland.
Many dogs and cats spend endless days indoors staring at the wall, living for the moment when you will come home and tell them you love them, take them out, and make a fuss over them. Dogs and cats need physical exercise and mental stimulation, things to do and think about in order to be healthy and happy. Please set time aside for them and give them a real life and real love. For more information, please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals at 757-622-PETA or helpinganimals.com. That's helpinganimals.com.
Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now?
Welcome, Paul Lakeland. And I already really know you because you were one of our early guests back when the show was first launched. I think we talked about our new Pope on the block.
I think we did, yes. I didn't realize it was an early show. I thought you were already very well established.
Oh, aren't you nice? No, I was feeling my way in a fog and kind of still am. But enough about me. As much as I've been looking forward to this conversation, I've also been half dreading it because it's... It just never ends, you know, the should I stay or should I going. And right now, I've got one foot and four toes out of the church. It's so hard, and I'm praying on it. That's all we can do. But the other thing, actually, we can do is talk to people like you.
Well, you can talk to people like me, although you should not assume that people like me are necessarily, you know, quite comfortable with the way things are going.
I know. You, very meaningfully, I think, are the author of The Liberation of the Laity in Search of an Accountable Church.
And you
are a former Jesuit. I mean, you are the complete package. So I'm going to ask just to get some perspective here, because maybe we're overreacting, we Catholics who just can't believe the church we're in.
No. I mean, I don't think people are overreacting at all. You know, I think the question is not about the intensity of the reaction, but the direction of the reaction, right? So I think, I mean, this is often somewhat exaggeratedly, maybe not so exaggeratedly, referred to in the press as the greatest crisis to hit the Catholic Church since the Reformation.
I was going to ask you that.
Probably an exaggeration, but not too much of an exaggeration, because the like at the time of the Reformation, the impact, among other things, was a draining of people away from their previous sense of belonging to the Catholic tradition.
Yeah.
So the intensity is, I think, appropriate. I mean, you know, you feel what you feel anyway, but I don't think that anyone should think, oh, I'm taking this too seriously. Not at all.
Do you have a grip on the numbers of people draining off?
No, I mean, how do you tell? You know,
yeah.
It's tricky. We do know that if you count attendance at Mass on a reasonably regular basis, which is one of the few statistics that we have, at least in the United States, then there's been a slow drain on that for the past 50 years,
right.
long before the sex abuse scandal became public knowledge. But over the last, about 18 years now, since the big news in Boston hit the press and people became aware of that, I think it's declined somewhat more and, you know, sits around, 20% of Catholics are now at church, more or less, so once a month or maybe more. So you've got 23% of the American population checks the box Catholic, but maybe it's really only more like, 5% of the American population who are actually actively Catholic at this point. Now, of course, that depends what you mean by Catholic, and that takes us right back to this question, to my point that the issue for Catholics facing the scandals is not to question the intensity of their response or the honesty of their response, but to ask where it should be directed.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
There's a tendency on the part of people, and I fully understand this, and to some degree I share it, because of the way the Catholic Church has taught people to think for centuries, to identify the church with the hierarchy, and therefore when the hierarchy goes wrong, or the clergy goes wrong, as, let's face it, a relatively small percentage of them have gone wrong, there's a tendency, because we are so hierarchy focused, to think, you know, we ditch the whole thing at this point, and as they say, you throw out the baby with the bathwater.
But really, if we want to practice, we can't disassociate from the hierarchy.
Well, it's not a matter of there will always be ministerial leadership in the church, and to some extent it's organized hierarchically. But our fundamental affiliation as Catholics is to the community of faith, not to the priest and the bishop.
Uh-huh.
So when we gather for the Eucharist, yes, there's a minister, but the minister presides on behalf of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And that is indicative of the fact that what's going on in the Eucharist is an act of the faithful people, not an act of the priest. So, you know, if you go back even to the early church, to the time of Augustine in the fourth century, there was this question, because of heresies that had been adopted by many of the clergy, and then eventually they had come to their senses and returned to the church, but they had this huge sin on their shoulders, and the question of the church was, can a priest who is in serious sin, I mean, they didn't use the category mortal sin then, but they probably were thinking of something like that, can this priest legitimately say Mass?
Right.
And, you know, for all sorts of reasons, the answer came back, yes, that the liturgy over which the priest presides, or the diocese over which the bishop presides, is not his diocese or his Mass, and therefore, if the priest conducts the Mass according to the appropriate rituals, it's a valid Mass from which everybody can gather grace. Now, if you think about it that way, you think, well, we have a sinful church. Well, we're all sinners, we know that, but we have a sinful church in which, at the present time at least, it's the clergy It's some of the clergy on whose sinfulness we are focused, whether it's priests abusing children or it's bishops turning a blind eye.
Okay.
That's the sinfulness we're focused on, but it remains a church that grace is present in and available to us in. And it's this is the issue for me, that we're hurt here by a couple of things. We're hurt by the scandals, of course we are. But we're also hurt by bad pedagogy that we have been taught for so long.
Yes.
To think about the church in terms of the clergy.
Yeah.
Mistake. Wrong. We think about the church in terms of the community of faith. So I go to my church. Now, I'm fortunate at my church because we have no awareness of any, you know, abuse that's ever occurred at this particular church. And actually now we have a woman in charge of our church, not a priest.
Oh, I read about
it. She brings in priests, but yes. Now she's in charge of the whole shebang. If I were to do what I fully understand people are thinking of doing, as you said yourself, one foot and four toes out of the church, what am I abandoning?
Right.
I'm abandoning the people I go to church with every Sunday. I'm not abandoning the gospel, no, but I can always find the gospel somewhere else.
Yeah.
But I am abandoning the people I go to church with every Sunday. I'm not abandoning the priest.
Okay.
Anyway. In my church, St. Anthony of Padua in Fairfield, until just about a year ago, we had a remarkable charismatic priest who had created a wonderfully ordinary but cooperative parish community. He was one of the most gifted preachers you've ever heard. He had muscular dystrophy that he was struggling with, but out of the blue, he contracted a melanoma and was dead in 5 months at the age of 58.
Oh.
His director of religious education, Dr. Eleanor Sowers, and the pastoral team that had been created stepped in to sort of keep things going while the bishop made his mind up about what to do next.
Right. A newish bishop.
It took the bishop about 8 months to decide that in this parish, the best thing to do would be formally to appoint Dr. Eleanor Sowers as Director of Pastoral Care and to allow her to, so to speak, import priests for the masses.
Yeah.
So we now have the only parish in the diocese and one of the very few in the Northeast that is led by a woman.
And what is her title?
Her title is Director of Pastoral Care.
Huh. It's an administrative job.
Well, it's a leadership job. I mean, mm-hmm. She has executive authority in the parish, and she reports directly to the bishop.
Can she do anything in the way of rituals?
Well, she can't say Mass, she can't hear confessions, and unfortunately, she can't preach.
Oh, ouch.
But anything else, I guess she could do.
Okay. She could bless people.
Well, you can bless people. Any any Christian.
I mentioned that.
A Christian can bless someone.
I just remember being astonished one, must have been Easter or that season, when a woman, she was the pastoral associate, walked up and down the aisle with the holy water and sprinkled it. I'm like, oh my gosh, we can do that?
Yeah, well, actually, some of that in our parish has been taken over, not by her, but over the years by some of the lay people, because the pastor with muscular dystrophy couldn't walk.
Oh, gosh, isn't that something?
So things changed.
Wow.
Because they had to, and people stepped in and appropriately and so on.
Well, you know, when I told a friend that I was going to be talking to you and asked her, does she have any thoughts, questions, comments, she
mm-hmm.
what she wants most is a sign of hope. And I think you just gave us one.
Well, I think I might have done.
You're listening to a conversation with Dr. Paul F. Lakeland, professor of Catholic Studies and chair of the Center for Catholic Studies at Fairfield University, helping us distraught Catholics answer the big question, should I stay or should I go? This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back with Paul after this.
It's a medical breakthrough, a doctor's prescription to help prevent cancer and improve survival rates. But you don't go to the pharmacy, you go to the supermarket for fruits, vegetables, and other high-fiber vegetarian foods. Side effects may include increased energy, healthy weight loss, and lower cholesterol. For a free recipe booklet, call 866-906-WELL or visit cancerproject.org.
So Eleanor is a sign of hope.
Yes.
For many people, and I think particularly for many women. But there's two additional signs of hope there. One is that it was the bishop who made this decision. Now, he's a pretty good bishop, don't get me wrong. He's always a deeply pastoral, very energetic guy. But I don't think he would be upset if he heard me say that... He kind of surprised us. It was a wonderful surprise that he saw the wisdom and prudence of doing what he decided to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, in some ways, he's leading other bishops to think imaginatively. I mean, it's not like, and so the other point about this sign of hope is, of course, it's not like he is pushing people aside in order to appoint her. I mean, he is in a way. Obviously, there are plenty of priests in the diocese who could have been appointed to this, but he realized that this was a working place, and it worked well, and it should be allowed to continue to work in the way it had been working.
Is it
so
truly?
As we move forward, if forward's the right word, and if we get beyond the scandal somewhat, which I would like to hope we will, it's nevertheless going to be true that there are going to be more and more parish communities where, given the shortage of clergy, they're going to have to be more imaginative about the way in which they understand models of leadership.
Well, that's
so,
what
yes,
I was going to say when you said there are plenty of priests. It's like, well, really? Not really.
Well, I don't mean there's plenty of priests, but there are priests in the diocese who, I'm guessing, now this is just me, I don't know for sure, who would have been probably quite happy to have been appointed pastor at St. Anthony's, but they weren't.
Right.
Why weren't they? Because the bishop saw that this community needed a particular kind of leadership, and the kind of leadership that Eleanor was offering in the tradition of our previous beloved pastor, John Barron, was what people needed.
It does feel like an inspired decision.
I think it was a great decision, and I think...
One that most bishops
also,
are...
Also, by the way, one that is allowed for in canon law. He wasn't doing anything he shouldn't do.
Okay. It dawned on me when I first read of this to reach out to your new person and ask her if she'd come on the program, and I thought, they're not going to let her come on this show.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Maybe ask her.
I think you should certainly ask her.
Okay.
I think she would take you seriously. I mean, what it's all, you know, from the perspective of our parish and from Eleanor's perspective and from the bishop's perspective and therefore from the diocese's perspective, this is all good news.
It is.
It's good news building on, growing out of a tragedy. It's
yes,
good news.
It is. My gosh, what a beautiful thing to come out of that horrible story.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have a few thoughts.
Yeah.
Just getting back to why we're all grinding our teeth down to nubs. One is that, I just looked it up, the movie Spotlight, which won the award for Best Picture, which should mean something, came out in 2015. And some of us may have foolishly thought that this sexual abuse business was behind us. You know, it's like, surely this isn't going to happen anymore. But no, you know, and the church just seems so stupid about it.
Well, it's not that stupid, honestly.
All right, help me out.
Because, you know, when we look hard at what the reality behind the movie Spotlight was dealing with, we see something precisely similar to what we saw in the Pennsylvania grand jury report last year. And that is, there was a horrific amount of terrible abuse. But by far the greater part of it took place more than 25 years ago. So, yes, we're horrified, and yes, we're certainly horrified by bishops dragging their feet, either bishops back then hiding or moving perpetrators, or bishops more recently dragging their feet about revealing information about perpetrators. But the worst of that abuse is apparently behind us. And although I'm not famous for applauding our bishops, they have done some things to deal with the situation, yes. And some of the changes have, yes, resulted in what seems to be a dramatic reduction in the amount of abuse. Now, there are various sorts of reasons for that. One reason is that, you know, people, lay people, parents of children, are not as passive as they used to be in face of a priest. Another reason is probably that there aren't as many priests around, so there aren't as many opportunities for contact if the priest is inclined in that direction. We are more open now than we were 30 or 40 and certainly 50 years ago when
okay.
the priest was...
Okay, yes. I certainly applaud any changes on this front. But the fact that there is a front and the scope of it being so vast and global, it can't help but make one wonder, like, what is it? Is there something about the institution? I know that there are scout troops and other religions and other organizations that suffer this calamity, but it just seems so almost endemic in the church to the
well,
church.
I mean,
like,
I'm not going to try and excuse anything. That's the last thing I want to do. But the percentage, the scale of sexual abuse within the Catholic Church by clergy is not much different from what it is in most other religious traditions in this country. Some are worse, some are better. The worst, the greatest, the most, the likeliest context in which abuse is going to occur is in the family. Hmm. So what we're looking at here, I think, no case of abuse is justified, and there are some sorts of structural reasons why this has happened in the Catholic Church, which could be addressed to dramatically reduce the amount of abuse. But the bigger issue is a structure that protects those abusers,
yeah,
not the actual, and it's hard to say this, but not the actual instance of abuse itself, horrible, yeah, horrifying as that is. That seems to be, I don't know how you put it, on the wane, or yeah, seems to be far reduced from what it used to be. But it, yeah, isn't clear to me that the structures that let that happen have been changed sufficiently that, that things are just going to be bright and sunny from now on.
When you read just a couple of weeks ago that the Jesuits have not been exempt from this, as a former Jesuit...
Oh, well, we knew that. I mean, I knew that.
You did.
I mean, yeah, because every diocese and every religious order is in the process of revealing the names of the people who they've been not revealing for the last 50 years. And, you know, I'm not surprised by that. I mean,
it didn't make your heart sink.
I've lived with and around Jesuits for about 60 of my 70 years, and one of my closest friends is the former provincial superior of the Jesuits in Britain, and I saw how having to deal with that in the British context damaged him enormously, and it took him years to get over it.
Wow.
Yeah,
see,
it doesn't
that's
surprise
the
me.
Collateral
it's,
damage.
It's deeply disappointing, but it doesn't surprise me. Hmm. Wherever you put weak men into close contact with young people, these things are going to happen. So the question is why weak men were so easily admitted into the ranks of the clergy. And that goes back to, predominantly, I think that goes back to inadequate formation and inadequate attention to what should go on in seminary education.
Hmm. So you say formation, you mean in the seminary or you mean in the family?
Well, I mean in the seminary.
Okay.
I don't blame the family. I mean, you know, the classic example of an abuser. Now, this is just like in the worst case, is a young person who decides, probably with the best of intentions, that he is interested in becoming a priest and enters into a minor seminary in 1955 at the age of 14, and for the next 10 years goes through minor and major seminary, never meets or talks to a woman who isn't a member of his family, and emerges as a ordained priest at the age of 24 and is thrown out into the world, into contact with people that he has no experience of dealing with, and as a result of a formation process that can have left him emotionally and sexually immature.
Hmm.
And so it blows up.
Wow.
So one of the things I think that has one of the signs of hope, shall we say, is that seminary formation has changed to a high degree. Now, one of the problems is it hasn't changed enough.
Okay.
What should really be happening in our seminary training is that seminarians should be being educated alongside the kind of people they will eventually serve. And they are in some places. So the Jesuits, for an example, just the ones I know, the Jesuit seminarians for the most part are trained, places like Boston College, where they're constantly interacting with ordinary people.
Right.
Not on a big house, in a big house on a hill somewhere in the middle of nowhere,
right,
which surrounded only by their fellow baby clergy, which is not the best way to form people.
Mm. Wow, that's certainly a cogent
description. Well, I think that increasingly people in the church, and by in the church now I mean the hierarchy, the bishops and the religious superiors and so on, I think they see the wisdom of that, and there does seem to be some movement in that direction. If there's any foot dragging, my guess would be it's because there's a fear that, you know, if you put them into a situation with regular people, that maybe the kind of commitment they might have to a lifetime celibate vocation will somehow or other become less ideal,
yeah,
as they interact with people. But all that's saying is, I think, that they're testing the vocations in the real world.
Yes. Yeah.
You are tuned to a chat with Dr. Paul F. Lakeland. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, or Really Trying Hard to Keep the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown.
Sure, humans can be a little weird at times, but take it from me, I'm a dog. And a person is about the best thing that can happen to a shelter pet. So if you want to learn how you can be that person, get down to your local pet shelter or visit theshelterpetproject.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
That's me in the corner.
Well, back to my foot and four toes.
Yeah, I thought you're right to keep coming back to that, yeah.
Through a kind of unfortunate confluence of events locally here in Connecticut, in my part of Connecticut, a wonderful, brilliant, soulful priest died at the age of 94, very close to 95 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And we members of his flock are bereft. And kind of coinciding with this is all of this horrible news about the abuse. And, you know, a lot of us have just had it. We just, you know, my friend that said she's looking for signs of hope, she's just dealing with it by, quote unquote, taking a break. You know, she's just not going to mass. It's been more than a month
right, but,
now.
But you're not bereft because he died at the age of 94.
We kind of are. We feel we've been left orphaned. And we know he had to die eventually.
Well, that's what I mean, exactly.
You know,
he seems to have had a pretty good inning.
He did. There's no question.
You'd have had to face this sooner or later.
I know. But in any case, now we are without this brilliant priest.
Mm-hmm.
He was a passionist, so mm-hmm. he wasn't a parish priest. It's not like we're leaving a parish. But we were something of a flock, those of us. Some of us went to daily mass because he was that good. Anyway, he's gone. The news is bad. And a few of us are putting our heads together to figure out what next, you know, like how maybe create a little small Christian community, do mass ourselves, you know. Gary Wills wrote that book, Why Priests? It's an excellent question. You know, we're smart. We are faithful. We get it. We love Jesus. Why can't we do this? There's no magic in it. You know, we can break bread and put wine in a cup as well as anybody. So, I mean, do you have any thoughts about that approach to survival?
Well, I mean, what I always say to people, you know, I mean, I can make all kinds of cases for one thing and another, but you have to do what is right for you and go where you find, you know, the grace of God and the truth of the gospel. So if that takes people from being Catholics to being Episcopalians or Orthodox or Quakers or off on their own somewhere, I don't think that's certainly not wrong. And in fact, if being in any particular community is a cause of scandal to a person, right? Scandal, you know, the classic term scandal means a stumbling block. So if being wherever you are becomes a stumbling block to a life of faith, then of course people should go and try to find somewhere where that is not the case.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, I've said that. I could repeat it, but I've said it, yeah.
Mm. And yet, you know, as we pursue this little off the beaten path way, we are aware that there are certain aspects of the traditional church that we will miss,
Like what?
Well, I don't know, the bells and smells, you know, just the sensory
things. Well,
okay,
you locked me in for the bells and smells. I'm
but,
pretty low
you know,
church.
There's beautiful things about church, you know. There's
well, the
music
most beautiful
and art
thing about church is the community of faith.
Yeah.
And the second most beautiful thing, I would tend to say, is the liturgy.
Yeah.
But the community of faith is... So it comes back to, you know, if you ask me, well, why don't you just go somewhere else? Well, it'd be a little bit tricky for me right at this moment because, you know, I've spent my life teaching Catholic theology, and this year alone, I'm president of the Catholic Theological Society of America. So it would be bad news for everybody if I went away.
Plus, but you're not inclined to.
But I'm not inclined to. I mean, it's not that I'm certainly not happy with, I've never been happy with lots of aspects of clericalism in the church more than anything else. Aside from long before we ever talked about sex abuse.
Yeah.
But what keeps me more than, certainly I don't stay for the clergy, although some of them are very good friends of mine, but I do stay for the sacramental life and the community of faith.
Right. And I think that's what I'm getting at.
What I would miss if I went off. I mean, yes, you can go off with a group of like-minded people, and I think you can probably create something that is very meaningful for you. But what about the people we leave behind?
Yeah.
That's a sadness. And maybe a necessary sadness, but it is a sadness.
Well, in my case, we would be taking these people with us.
All of them?
Well...
Okay.
The regulars.
Well, yeah, you'd be taking the people who agree with you, right?
But,
you know, the old James Joyce definition of the Catholic Church, here comes everybody.
Yeah.
And we have to, I think that we, one of the good things about a parish, I mean, parishes, of course, have different personalities, but yeah. One of the good things about a good parish is that it tries to be inclusive.
Yes. Lately,
and I think when we decide that, and please don't misunderstand me, I think it's a legitimate thing to do, but when we decide that, you know, for the sake of our souls, we have to go off and join another church or create another community, that is not a bad thing, but it does have a cost. And you said yourself you have missed certain things,
yeah.
And I think that's right. But we are also, when we do that, we are also not just missing certain things, but abandoning something, and that something we're abandoning is mostly people.
Hmm.
Now, might be that the people that get abandoned think, well, thank God they've gone. Now we can get on with things. You know, now we can get back to what we used to do.
Right. Oh, that's funny. Well, a couple of thoughts. One is that I attend Mass lately, since the passing of my dear friend especially, here on campus at Wesleyan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's charming because it's in a non-denominational chapel, and they basically wheel a cross out and put a cloth on the table, which serves for an altar. And it's pretty spare, but speaking of the people, you know, the students, and you're at Fairfield University, maybe you've observed this yourself, the students are remarkably devout. You know, they put their face in their hands after communion, and they pray, and there's not even kneelers, so they're on the linoleum, you know. It's just so lovely.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I think, you know, it's funny that places differ. You know, most Catholic students in this country go to public institutions, or in, like Wesleyan, a private institution that's not church-related.
Right.
Catholic schools, it's strange at Fairfield. I mean, yes, our students are devout, but it's a small minority of them.
Huh.
Most of them never go near the church.
Interesting. We have
and the ones
quite...
who are devout, I don't know whether this is true of your, but I suspect it is, what I would call mildly evangelical in their orientation.
So they're right-leaning.
At least in church matters.
Yes, yes.
And we don't kneel on the floor because we don't have kneelers, so we stand, which is stand or sit. And standing is, of course, the correct liturgical posture for praying.
Very good. The other thing I was going to say, and it came to mind when you used the word cost in another context, but it came to mind, it's the business of putting money in the basket in a parish when you read how many millions have gone toward legal fees. And, I mean, the breaking point for another couple friends of mine was when the church was going to the Capitol to object to a change in the statute of limitations on sexual abuse. You know,
yeah,
it's like, yikes.
Unconscionable.
Really?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we can belong.
That happened in Hartford?
Yes. Mm. And we can feel good about our people and our parish, but really, we can't deny that we're part of a big, honking, corrupt corporation that is not using our money well or transparently.
I think that can be the case. I certainly think that kind of feeling that, you know, we gave the money, we should have more control over how it's spent is absolutely accurate. I think it varies a bit. This is not kind of excusing anything, but it varies a bit from diocese to diocese. I mean, I know that here Bishop Caggiano has published a complete financial statement, including a complete financial statement of where the money came from that paid off the various sex abuse issues. And the way that he's put it out there, none of this money came out of the collection plate.
Mm.
It came out of insurance, it came out of selling land and things like that, but it did not come out of the collection plate. And I don't know how true that is in every diocese, and I'm quite sure that in most places they have not been as open as that. The most important thing, I think, is not where the money came from, but how transparent the diocesan authorities are about making public to people what was spent and where what was spent came from.
Well, our Archbishop can't win because he did come out and make a statement, but my friend observed that he just looked so smug and it seemed pretty glib of him to say, okay, now let's move on. Let's forgive and forget, you know? And it's like, wait, excuse me.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Well, I'm not going to comment on the Archbishop.
I know.
Every diocese is different, and unfortunately, one of the things that does go with hierarchy is that lay people do not have an effective voice in addressing issues. And that's why people often think about, well, what if we stop putting money in the plate? Would they start listening? But of course, most of the money you put into the collection plate goes to support your own community.
Well,
and you don't want to... Right. Your own parish community.
I mean, putting the roof on the church.
You don't want to hobble that. There's all kinds of good things down there.
Yep.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Dr. Paul F. Lakeland of Fairfield University about the challenges of staying in a church that's taking too damn long to change. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown.
For music from the 1960s and 70s, tune in to The Light Fandango. It's not the usual oldies, but uncommon tracks from across the genres. Everything from pop to R&B, soundtracks to electronica, folk to international. That's The Light Fandango, heard every 1st, 3rd, and 5th Sunday of the month from 4 to 5:30 p.m. right here on WESU 88.1 FM.
These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.
Is this how Jesus planned it? You know, that we
absolutely
should...
not.
You know, I mean, it just feels...
No, of course he didn't. Insofar as we can tell from the Gospels, Jesus was a man who was a reforming Jewish rabbi. I don't think for a minute he imagined a church. He certainly imagined the purification of the Jewish tradition as he saw it. And what we have, I mean, if you want to sort of look at it theologically, what we have is what the Spirit of God brought about through the historical process. But the historical process is seeded with sinfulness as well as righteousness and piety. So we get a very spotty thing. But in terms of the details of the structure of the Catholic Church, while it might be or might have been just the thing for the times, it certainly, you could never say Jesus envisaged it. You could say you could make the claim that it is faithful to the kernel of ideas and reforming impulses that he seems to have had. So you can make the case that it's a logical development. But you can't make the case that he saw it coming. No.
Right. No. He probably had no thought of launching a religion.
Oh, I don't think he did. No.
Yeah.
Of course not.
But he loved women. You know, he was so good to the women in his life. He respected them so. He listened to them so. He embraced them. How can we have this long-standing, unmoving blind spot about that? I mean, it's...
Well, don't ask me to defend that. I mean, I think that that's just sinfulness, personally.
And so short-sighted. There's so much talent going to waste.
Yeah, there is. You know, I don't know if I ever told you this, but the very first book that I wrote was a book I do not recommend. It was a tiny little, almost a large pamphlet. and it was called Can Women Be Priests? And I wrote this book in 1976.
Oh, my gosh.
And I certainly don't think it was a good book, but the objective was to show, really, there are no theological reasons why we couldn't ordain women, right? But what's interesting about the book to me is not the content of the book, but the fact that it received official approval, or what's called imprimatur, by the Archdiocese of Cork in Ireland, a place you cannot get, well, in those days anyway, that nothing was more Catholic than Cork.
Yes.
So what's this, 24, 34, 40, 43 years ago, this was a legitimate statement to make.
Wow.
Now you can't make it anymore. At least if a member of the clergy or a bishop made that kind of claim, they would be in deep trouble.
This is fascinating.
Yeah, it is. So it was orthodox at one time, and now it's heretical.
Oh, God.
Not heretical, but unacceptable.
There goes the hope we felt.
No, I don't think so, because I do not think that it's gone away. I mean, you know, Pope John Paul II could say the case is closed, and Pope Francis, poor guy, can't do much more than say, well, I guess the case is closed, but it isn't closed. It's not closed forever, anyway.
Okay, let's look into the crystal ball here. What do you think is ahead for the church? What is coming of all of this? Something's got to be born out of this mess.
Well, yeah. I don't claim to have any particular sort of hotline to the Holy Spirit, but if the church is not simply going to decline and disappear or become irrelevant, what's coming will be, I think, a somewhat smaller church and a church in which patterns of ministry will change dramatically, which will certainly mean, of course, and the Pope is, I think, clearly in favor of this, the relaxation of the rules for mandatory celibacy for the clergy, that's going to change.
Okay.
When that happens, it won't change anything for those already ordained, but it will mean quite a different kind of mix of people entering ministry, even if the ministry has not opened to women at that point. So that's going to happen. And the shortage of clergy is, I suspect, one of the ways in which the Holy Spirit is pushing the church in the direction of being a little bit more imaginative than it has been for many centuries.
Yeah.
I personally think that the social teaching of the church needs to and probably will become more prominent in a smaller church. But that might be because just my own more, I guess, what do we call them, more liberal political views incline me to think that a smaller church will be more progressive. But there are lots of people who think a smaller church will be more conservative, and that will be a good thing too.
Well, maybe two small churches.
Well, see, that could result. I mean, people have talked about the possibility of a schism in the church.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem about to happen, but who knows?
You know, we have just a few minutes left, but I can't resist telling you. I got an email yesterday from a retreat house here in Connecticut, and they were looking for people to sign up for... Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Dinner with a deacon.
Dinner with a deacon? Oh.
I'm like,
is the deacon going to cook it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what deacons were. They were people who waited table.
I don't know why that struck me so funny.
Dinner with a deacon. Well, maybe it won't be long before it's dinner with a female deacon.
Exactly. Wouldn't that be great?
That would be great, provided she's not expected to cook the meal.
I don't know. It's just, if you don't laugh, you cry. That's where we're at, you know? It's
yeah,
just...
Yeah, we are. And, you know, I don't know. There's an old saying which you've undoubtedly heard before. The mills of God grind slow, but they grind exceeding fine.
Uh-huh.
Things take time, and
I know
most of us are too. And this has nothing to do with sex abuse, but leaving that aside for a minute, talking about change in the church, I think we're just called to creative impatience, but a long view.
Oh, I like this. Creative
that
impatience. That feels like something. So, but talk a little more about that. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, we cannot expect things to happen overnight. The kind of things we might want to see happening in the church, like the changes in patterns of ministry or the inclusion of women in ministry and so on, we can't expect things to happen overnight. They just don't. You know, there's a line somewhere in St. Paul, and I can't tell you where it is, which says, you know, in the new dispensation, everything is permissible, but not everything is helpful.
Mm.
So it's a matter of figuring out timing on some things, not just... So, you know, if you applied St. Paul's idea there to our church today, you would have to say, well... There's really no reason why we couldn't have married clergy or female clergy or, you know, any of these things in principle and theologically. But we do have to make sure that what we do does not destroy the community of faith.
Mm-hmm.
So it's timing, right?
Yes.
Now, unfortunately, we're not in the church today. We're not talking about timing. We've got all kinds of fatuous theological arguments like, well, Jesus never ordained a woman, and therefore.
Right.
But, so we can't expect things to happen quickly, but they'll never happen if we don't agitate.
Okay, excellent. You read my mind. I mean, if this were legislation, we could contact our Congress
yeah.
people.
Yeah.
Should we be writing letters to the bishop? What's your best advice for how to proceed to keep ourselves...
Well, you can write letters to the bishop. Of course you can. But my own view has always been that we work for change within our own local community.
And not vote with our feet like we're...
Well,
with
that's
our feet
not my
and
way,
toes.
But I'm not criticizing people who come to that conclusion.
Of course,
I fully understand that. But
yeah.
I just feel like I was giving up.
See, that's the thing. My husband said to me, you know, you left once already, and you came back. I mean, how many times are you going to leave?
Well, you can come and go multiple times. The door will always be open.
Oh, my gosh. Paul Lakeland, I don't know. I feel better somehow having talked to you.
Well, I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, thank you so much.
But it wasn't something I did. It was something in the air.
Something in the air. Well, you know, we can't neglect that there is... It's not all up to us.
Absolutely nothing. None of it's up to us. But what's the old saying, you know? Pray as if everything depends on God, but act as if everything depends on you.
Ah, perfect. Perfect way to close. I put my hands together and bow. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great to talk to you.
Always a pleasure. Come back soon.
Whenever you ask me.
That was a visit with Dr. Paul F. Lakeland, professor of Catholic Studies and chair of the Center for Catholic Studies at Fairfield University. I'll post the podcast of the episode later this evening at reasonablycatholic.com so you can share it with any fellow grouchy Catholics who might benefit from Paul's wisdom. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Be sure to tune in 2 weeks from today, February 19th, when Commonweal critics Richard Oliva and Rand Richards Cooper will bat around the Oscar nominations in our annual roundup. Till then, I'm Maria Johnson. Thanks for listening. Now stay tuned for The Jive at 5, followed by Wonderland with DJ Cheshire Cat.